the whale, marine mammal of the order Cetacea. They comprise three groups, one Archaeocetae, believed to have been derived from the Credonta, the primitive fossil members of the carnivora. Their teeth consist of three incisors, one canine, four premolars, and 3 to 2 molars on either side of each jaw. A milk dentition is found. Two, Mystacocetae, or whalebone whales, in which the mouth contains fine plate-like structures supported by the palate in place of teeth. And three, Odontocetae, or toothed whales, believed to have descended from the Archaeocetae, which includes sperm whales, dolphins, and porpoises. The most prized...
Despite a move towards conservation at last month's meeting of the International Whaling Commission, many countries are still slaughtering these beautiful animals. The environmental group Greenpeace is once again sailing with its ship, the Rainbow Warrior, to the waters around Iceland to protest the killing. The Rainbow Warrior came alongside Radio Caroline just a few days ago, and we had a chance to talk to Peter Wilkinson. Firstly, I asked him about an injunction which has been taken out against Greenpeace.
Well, when we arrived in Iceland about the beginning of June, within 2 or 3 days we were arrested. A gunboat came out and told us to come back to port. We asked...
On what grounds were you?
Well, exactly, that's exactly the point. We weren't told the grounds that we'd been arrested. And we still don't know, in actual fact, what the grounds are. But we were arrested twice in all and taken back to Reykjavik by gunboats. And eventually an injunction was served on Greenpeace. And we're still yet to find out exactly the wording of the injunction and what it entails.
That was served by the Icelandic government?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
So that's still pending against you?
Yes, it is right now, yes.
So basically, Ryan, you're going back to Iceland now with this thing against you?
Well, that's right, but we won't be going into Reykjavik, obviously, and we'll be steering clear of their 12-mile limit, and we'll be in international waters. It's just really a question of how they're going to react to us returning. And it could go either way. They could leave us alone and we could carry on because we're in international waters, or they could come and seize us. And if they seize us, then it's going to be a court case. And we have a lawyer in Iceland who's working on the case right now, and he maintains that there's nothing in the Icelandic constitution that warrants our arrest. So it would be an interesting case, obviously.
It certainly would be if they arrested you outside the limit, of course.
Well, exactly, right, yeah. But, I mean, the point about us going back is we've had a long debate about it, to be quite honest with you. It seems to us that although Iceland voted in favour of conservation measures on a couple of points at the International Whaling Commission meeting, they're still killing whales. They're still killing fin whales and sperm whales, and we need to go back there. There's a shift, a very definite shift in favour of conservation throughout the whaling world now, and we think we may be able to do a little bit more good by going back.
The whales they catch in Iceland, I mean, that's, I mean, what use are they put to? Is that, do they go to like Japan or Europe or where?
Yes, Japan buys nearly all the whale meat that they produce. The sperm whale comes, some of it comes to the UK and to the rest of Europe. And in fact, the meat that is exported to Japan constitutes less than 1% of the whole protein intake of the Japanese people, which they could obviously do without. And the sperm oil that comes into the UK and other places, they're perfectly adequate substitutes for it.
Mm-hmm. But they use the oil for all sorts of strange things, don't they? Like softening leather.
That's right. It's basically used as a leather softener and also as an industrial lubricant. But we have evidence to say that countries that have banned sperm oil, the states in particular, they've suffered no setbacks to their economy and no redundancies at all.
The whole thing about the whales, you know, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people that are listening maybe don't know anything about whales at all. And maybe you could give us some background on, like, you know, the population decline and the ways in which the hunters actually go after these animals.
Yeah, sure. Well, they've been around for about 50 million years for a start, which puts them in a different league to us. We've only been around for a few hundred thousand years. They were land animals originally. They're air-breathing mammals, and as their size increased, they took to the seas. And they've become enormous animals. They're the largest, well, the blue whale in particular is the largest living mammal ever to have roamed the earth. They've developed incredibly complex language and incredibly complex social system. And their brain size is such that many scientists believe that they could compete with man for intelligence. And here we are, blasting them out of the water with 160-pound explosive harpoons. Which travel at about 60 miles an hour on impact. And it's been likened to shooting a horse going around the streets in an armoured car, shooting a horse with an equivalent explosive device, and letting the horse drag the armoured car around until it dies of exhaustion, which is just about what happens. if it was done on land, if animals were killed like that on land, there'd be an enormous outcry and it'd be banned immediately. But because it happens at sea, and because the animal is largely under the water, people tend to take a different attitude to it. But I must stress that our attitude to the whole whaling campaign is that we're an environmental group. We're concerned about the viability of the environment in general. And the prime concern with us, obviously we are concerned about the cruelty aspect, but we want to see the species survive. Because the more diverse the world is, the more stable we are. We're at the top of a food chain. And obviously to keep as many species alive as possible and to help them thrive and interact is good for us.
They're also amazingly friendly animals, aren't they, I've heard?
Yeah, surprisingly so. You would have thought they would have been just the opposite, but they're very, very gentle animals, and they have only one or two predators, and obviously the biggest one is man, but it's only killer whales that will ever attack another whale.
Oh,
IWC meeting, I mean, what precisely did it this year achieve? I mean, we've heard so much. I think there was a lot of publicity, I mean, particularly on television, radio, about the International Whaling Commission meeting in London. And what did it achieve? Because I think now everybody's got a little bit blasé about it. It's over, and everybody's just sitting back saying, well, it's happened, there's got all the bans and everything. I mean, what are the bans that are on, and what's going on with the whales now?
Well, the two main features of the IWC, the things that the conservationists are hooraying about, is that the Indian Ocean is now a whale sanctuary for 10 years. Only the minke whale, sadly, can be hunted in the Indian Ocean. And the other big step in the right direction is the fact that deep-sea whaling, or pelagic whaling as it's called now, is banned. So that really does put pressure on Japan and Russia on their factory fleets. But there's a lot of wheeling and dealing goes on in the International Whaling Commission, and there are a lot of trade-offs. And some people have traded off things that we'd like to have seen stopped. The bowheads in particular, which is the most endangered species in the world regarding whales. The Eskimos have been given a quota of, I think it's 18 taken, or 27 struck and lost, as they call it. So there's a lot of trade-off, and they could have gone a lot further. But those are the two main planks of the success we think we've had.
Because you really, I've read that the best thing is, you know, like people are calling for a 10-year complete moratorium, aren't they?
That's right. Well, that's always been the platform of the anti-whaling lobby. But this year it seemed to us the most sensible thing to do was to try to save some whales at least. So we lobbied, along with other groups, we lobbied all the delegates to the IWC, and the USA, in fact, put forward a moratorium for a total ban on whaling. And it was obvious in the technical committee that this wasn't going to get very far. So the Panamanian delegate asked if the proposal could be amended into two parts, deep sea whaling and coastal whaling. And it was finally adopted, and the deep sea whaling was passed. And there is no deep sea whaling now. If we had have left the original proposal, it would have failed totally. So it has been a bit of a compromise, but it's one that's certainly worth going for.
Excuse me. Panama is withdrawing from the IWC, I understand.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I read something about it somewhere. I'm not quite sure what that's all about.
Well, they were bought off last year, in actual fact. Japan bought them off because they put forward the 10-year moratorium proposal on last year's IWC, and there was trade pressure put onto Panama, we think, by Japan. And I think the whole business is a bit disgusting to some nations, mm-hmm. really. I mean, it is a big wheeling and dealing operation.
There's tremendous support now. I mean, like in the last couple of years, I mean, there's been grassroots support, hasn't there? For, I mean, people are becoming much more aware of what this whole thing is about. What's the best way in which, say, just an ordinary person that's listening to this program can actually help to do something?
Okay, the first thing I think is that pelagic whaling, deep sea whaling is now finished, but the coastal whaling is still thriving. And it's the markets for the byproducts of whales from coastal whaling that have got to be terminated. And I think if anyone's listening and wants to do anything, they ought to find out if their country imports sperm oil. And if it does, they ought to raise the question with not only their parliament and their respective members of parliament, but also ought to raise it with their trade associations or any clubs or organisations that they belong to. Resolutions have got to be put forward, which have to be discussed at the annual general meeting of those organisations. In particular, the trade unions can be of great help here. I mean, we've had a dialogue going with the Transport and General Workers Union for some months now. They're the blokes in the UK that actually truck the stuff from the ports, the sperm oil, truck it from the ports to the refinery. And we've been asking them if they will take a fresh look at the whole whaling issue for us and stop handling the stuff. And although they haven't actually come out and said they're going to stop handling it, they have made representations to the government. And with the weight of the Transport and General Workers Union behind this campaign, it's looking good, really. And I think that's what every individual can do. And as far as Iceland's concerned, as I've already said, writing to the Prime Minister of Iceland, I mean, even 10,000 letters to arrive on the desk of the Icelandic Prime Minister just before we return or whilst we're up in the Icelandic whaling grounds will go a hell of a way to helping the campaign, really.
And they can also get in touch, of course, with Greenpeace in Colombo Street.
Yes, of course, yeah. We live in southeast London. It's called Colombo Street, and it's just near Blackfriars Bridge.
Can you remember the telephone number off hand?
Yes, it's 633-0929, and we have offices in France and Holland also.
Yeah, right, that's right, because in Holland it's Damrak 98, and I'm not quite sure the address in France.
It's 31 Rue du Mail.
Excellent, that's in Paris.
That's right, yeah. Yeah.
with eyes like a stormy day. He tossed his head and he called my name, and together we rode away. On the ocean floor was a mighty crowd of the children of the sea, gathered there for a last farewell and a last sad look at me. I saw what man the child had done by playing man the king. The stupid, blind, destructive waste of every living thing. The whale, the turtle, and the seal were last of all to come. It was hard for them to touch my hand after all that I had done. When the love had swum away and the seahorse brought me home, I stood once more upon the sand, and I knew I was all alone. But all at once it came to me as I looked out on the sea.
Greenpeace is not only concerned, is it, with the whales. I mean, it's an environmental group that's involved in all sorts of other things. I understand you were out recently with the boats when they were monitoring the dumping of nuclear waste in the ocean.
That's right, yes. Since 1949, the UK has been dumping radioactive waste at sea. It hasn't always been out in international waters. Up until 1967, they were dumping it in a place called the Herd Deep, which is just 20 miles north of Guernsey in the Channel Islands, and they were also dumping it in the Bay of Biscay. And then someone said to somebody else, perhaps it's not a very good thing to do because it's on continental shelves. Mm. And not only that, they have dumped in the past quite a few tons of old World War II explosives in the Herd Deep. So there's a fair old mishmash of pretty dangerous material down there. So in 1967, they decided that they would take it out to international waters. And the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, oversees the annual disposal of about 7,000 tons of radioactive waste from four European countries, the UK included. And there's a lot of grounds for concern about that particular operation. The United States, in fact, stopped dumping in 1970 on environmental grounds. And we've put together a statement of concern, which has been signed by about 20 British MPs, by scientists and physicists and doctors from the States and from Europe, asking the government to stop it. Because there are grave fears that the radioactivity will build up and will find its way through the food chain and eventually to us. And I'm sorry I'm going on a bit on this one, but the International Atomic Energy Authority itself published a pamphlet in which it admitted that you could expect a 10% reduction in fish, even at very, very low levels of exposure to radiation. And I mean, if this is the problem we've got now, the UK has got to get rid of this stuff somewhere, and they're tipping it out at sea in international waters, which in itself is a crime. But what's going to happen in 10, 15 or even 20 years' time if we really go ahead with nuclear power in Europe? the amount of waste that's going to be generated is going to be a big, big problem. It's a problem now insofar as they have to dump it out at sea, but it's just going to be compounded if the nuclear power system, the nuclear power program goes ahead in lots of European countries. It really is a frightening prospect.
Well, of course, I've heard the argument, but it's dispersed through the sea, but then, of course, that doesn't allow for the fact that, you know, on the area in which it's dumped, there are quite high levels, aren't there, of radioactivity locally.
Well, it's never been monitored, as far as I know. I've been trying now for 6 months to find out if any surveys have been taken of that particular dumping area, and I've been told that the UK is now in negotiations to find out if a meaningful surveillance system can be mounted, whatever that particular phrase
means. They don't have anything at the moment?
Not as far as I know, not as far as I can ascertain. And the other worrying thing is that when we were out in the dumping ground a few weeks ago, the United Kingdom Atomic Energy Authority make a great play of saying it's clear of fishing grounds, clear of shipping routes and undersea cables. We came across a fleet of 25 Spanish fishing vessels inside the dumping zone. They had no idea it was used as an area of radioactive waste dumping. And we've raised the question with the Atomic Energy Authority and haven't had a reply yet. But it does seem to us, at face value anyway, and we have this on film, that there are countries fishing in that dumping ground. And the fact is that they don't know quite what the answer is going to be. They make their prognostications and their calculations on mathematical models. And we're only going to find out empirically what the problems are and what the results are going to be perhaps 20 years hence. And there's no way of decontaminating an ocean. And on that ground, and on the grounds of the fact that we have people like Professor Najarian and Dr. Goffman from the States, who are very well known for their the pamphlets and the information they've given on low-level radiation, we want them to stop it. And we want to raise the question of whether we're going in the right direction with nuclear power. Because if we've got this scale of problem right now, it's going to be compounded in the future. And it really does raise the basic problem about nuclear power.
Because everybody saw that news film on television just a few weeks ago when that was going on. It was amazing to see all those fishing boats there, you know, in that very area.
That's right, yes. It amazed us too, I can tell you.
How exactly is the nuclear waste packed?
It's packed in steel drums, concrete lined, and the waste, which is basically aprons, gloves, beakers, bits of pipe, which have been contaminated with low-level radioactivity, are stuffed inside, the thing's sealed, and then it's put on board the ship. It's either the Gem or the Topaz that's been used recently, and then taken out to sea. But the sad thing is that the lids have been known to come off, barrels have been known to float. In one instance, when they were using the Topaz a few years ago, they had an island of radioactive rubbish floating around the ship, which had to be picked up and repackaged back in Belgium, I think the country was that was dumping at that particular time. So there's a whole cavalier attitude to getting rid of this waste. You know, the nuclear industry nuclear power itself is supposed to be the cleanest form of fuel, and the whole thing is sold as a futuristic clean fuel. But they don't tell you what's going out through the back door, and they certainly don't tell you a lot of the information that ought to be available to the public. Firstly, about the safety of the advanced gas cooled reactor, which is the design that we're going for in the UK at the moment. A safety report was commissioned a few years ago, which has never been published. And we want to know why, and we want to see it, because they're building AGRs right now.
Was that commissioned by the government or the Atomic Authority?
By the government. It was commissioned by the government, yeah. And they've never made it public, which is worrying. So there are a lot of facets about nuclear power which people have got to be appraised of before they can make a decision, and really think that nuclear power ought to be looked at as one of the options for the future. At the moment, we're channeling a mere £6 million into alternative energy development, and with that sort of research money available, we're not going to get anywhere. The amount of money we're spending on nuclear power is staggering. I think it was something like £14 million just for research and development just a couple of years ago. So, there's no alternative to nuclear power. There's no one alternative. It won't be the sun, it won't be water power, it won't be any of those alternatives on its own. It'll be, firstly, we've got to have a fresh look at energy generation, electrical energy generation. We've got to go for decentralisation, we've got to go for efficiency, we've got to go for the conservation of heat loss through buildings. And when you get to that situation, if you start conserving energy right now, you'll be able to have a really fresh look at energy generation, because you'll have a much longer lead time before oil, coal and all the fossil fuels run out, and it'll give you time to sit there and discuss and argue about how you're going to generate electrical energy in the future. But at the moment we're just going hell for leather for nuclear power at the cost of everything else. Nobody seems to be particularly bothered about alternative energy structures.
What?
the other types of alternative energy? I mean, we hear a lot about sort of solar power and wind power and things. I mean, just how viable are those?
Well, if you think of providing, I mean, at the moment we generate 66 gigawatts of electrical energy.
What's
in the
a
UK.
Gigawatt?
Well, I couldn't tell you that. It's a lot. But if that's your target, then you can't look at solar power, for instance, and say it's going to meet all the demands, and you can't look at water power to say the same thing about that. But in their own way, and if we structured things differently, they could all contribute. If we went for, firstly, conservation, it's a must, absolutely, because we've got to lengthen our lead time as long as possible. Secondly, we've got to look at the way in which we convert fuel into electricity, which is done very, very inefficiently at the moment. Coal-fired power stations run on about 30% efficiency, and the other 70%. Yeah, right. The other 70% goes up the chimney. So we've got to convert fuel efficiently, and we've got to apply it efficiently. The most stupid way of heating a room, says he, as he looks at no, it's not electric fire, is to use an electric fire. There's more energy falling per square meter on the Earth's surface than we can ever use, and that energy has got to be used for space heating. And once you heat rooms and factories with the with solar power, then your demand for primary energy drops dramatically, and you can generate electricity to be used in much more sensible ways. And it's only if you take that sort of approach that alternatives to nuclear power become attractive. And it can be done, and it should be done, because I think the thing that sums it up for me is that the problems you're going to encounter with nuclear power are insoluble. They don't know how to get rid of the waste safely. That's low, medium and high. But the problems you encounter on the alternative energy path are soluble. We have the technology available. All we need is the political will to put it into motion. But if we go for nuclear power, we're going to really be in trouble.
They're grading things into low, medium and high. It's a bit to me like low, medium and high tar cigarettes. The low one just kills you a bit more slowly. Is that the same sort of thing?
Yeah, you could say that. Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, the high level waste is lethal, absolutely lethal. I mean, it's carried around in thick lead shielding. The low level stuff is treated a lot more casually, but it's still treated pretty carefully. The thing about the low level waste, you know, is that one of the reasons they're dumping it out in international waters is that it's impregnated with plutonium. Now, the low-level stuff, they normally land tip at a place called Drigg in the UK, but the stuff that's impregnated with plutonium can't be tipped there due to the fact that anything with plutonium involved in it, if you have a fire and the stuff with plutonium impregnated in it is burnt, then the plutonium goes in the atmosphere, and you only need to inhale about a millionth of a gram of plutonium to increase your chance of getting lung cancer pretty considerably.
Really?
Right. The UK have 7.5 ton of plutonium in store at Windscale at the moment.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
What else is Greenpeace involved in? I mean, we know about the nuclear side, we know about the whales. I mean, where else is Greenpeace going at, you know?
Well, it's very difficult, actually, to plan a long-term strategy, simply because we're so few people, and we're trying to keep it that way because we think we can become an effective unit, working very efficiently that way. But at the moment, our three areas of concern are seals. We're against the Newfoundland kill of harp and hooded seals, which is the largest slaughter on the face of the earth of any marine mammals. They kill about 195,000 a year. We're obviously concerned about the whaling situation, and we've dedicated a lot of time to that since we've been in existence in the UK, and nuclear power, but we're really concentrating on those three issues. We could get involved in a million and one others, but the only other thing we're doing in a long-term basis is we're having a look at the Mediterranean, and our French office is working out a feasibility study of a campaign in the Mediterranean, which is close to death as an inland sea. And that's the only sort of long-term thing we've got planned at the moment.
Yeah, because the Med is really sort of screwed up at the moment, isn't it?
That's right, they're dumping heavy metals, and daily they're dumping tons of heavy metals there, and all sorts of rubbish is being pumped out from all the Mediterranean countries.
Now, obviously, Greenpeace as an organisation worldwide, it relies for its existence upon the goodwill of people who feel that they could possibly contribute in some way to the organisation. And is it very important? I mean, obviously, it's very important to have people that want to give somehow to the whole thing. Is it very important funding-wise at the moment? I mean, you know, how do you sort of go for funding?
Well, it's been a hand-to-mouth existence, to be quite honest, ever since we've been around in the UK. What we've done to try to compensate for that is that we've linked up with the French office and the Dutch office, and we work very closely with them, and we try to finance the campaigns jointly from the three offices. There's many reasons for that, not the least of which is the fact that we try to attack problems which are international, which transcend national barriers. So the campaigns that we run at the moment are European rather than British or whatever. And so the prospect for funding is looking a bit rosier because we've linked up with France and Holland. But obviously money is the be-all and end-all of an operation like ours, because it costs a lot of money to run the ship. But really, we're doing this work because we want results. And obviously results come from having enough money to do the things you want to do. But they also come from people believing in what we're trying to do and helping us as much as possible in the most practical way. And the most practical way is sometimes not coming into the office and buying a t-shirt or whatever, but to take a leaf out of our book, see what we're trying to do. It's non-violent, it's direct. We try to expose the bare nerve, if you like, in a particular campaign and stand on it until it hurts, until we get some sort of action. And I think people are beginning to stand up for themselves a lot more just recently. And there's lots of groups now who are not prepared to take dictates from the government at face value, and are prepared to question it and argue about it through whatever channels possible, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, I have often thought, you know, one way that, like, a lot of our people that listen are quite young, and maybe some of them belong to youth clubs or are still at school or things. I suppose, it would be possible for them to do things like sponsored walks, discos, whatever, to raise money.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, we do rely on a lot of individuals and groups just like that to raise money for us, and without that sort of work being done for us, they don't get any headlines in papers, unfortunately. But without that sort of operation, we wouldn't be able to exist, and we're really doing this work on their behalf. We're just a focal point for the concern that's not only national now, but international. And we act a lot of the time as a catalyst in a particular situation. We create the interest, and really it's the public that have got to change government's opinion. We can go out there and we can do what we can, and we can get the publicity for it, but then there's got to be follow-up, and the follow-up's got to come from the public, because they're the people that are going to change government's opinion.
So, like, if there are people listening who'd like to do that, should they get in touch with you first before they go ahead and say run a sponsored disco or a sponsored walk or what?
Oh, yes, I think that would be a best idea, because we have quite a bit of expertise now in running that sort of thing, and it's always nice to know who's doing what. And obviously, if we can spare anybody, we'll send someone down to that particular do. And that's really really where a lot of our money comes from.
All right, and if anybody is listening that's interested in that, if they get in touch with Greenpeace, they're in Columbus Street, SE1, in London. And obviously, if you have something going like that, if you can organise it maybe 3 or 4 weeks in advance, so it's very simple for us to publicise it on the station as well, which
right,
is a good show,
sure.
And we can get that one together. Listen, it's been absolutely fantastic talking to you. It's amazing. I have so much admiration for you people and for what you're about to do up in Iceland. You
well,
really don't
thank
know.
Thank you. That's very nice of you, Tony. But before you close me off, I'd just like to say that you've been doing a lot of work for us, and it's the first time we've met, and I'd like to thank everybody on the boat and yourself as well.
Thank you. That's really nice. I mean, you know, the people you really want to thank, actually, more than anything else, is the listeners, because they're the ones that got up off their asses and they went down to the walk on the South Bank.
Oh, that was a magic thing, really. That was fantastic.
Well, yeah.
Well, if any walkers are listening, thank you. Really, a big, big thank you. It was a fantastic do, and that whole weekend really had an influence on the IWC. There's been Friends of the Earth, all the whale groups, Greenpeace, everybody. There must be 1,000 unsung heroes on the whale campaign, because they've really worked hard and they've shifted the IWC. Really, that the first time that there's been any even acknowledgement for the conservationists, and they've really gone overboard. We've won a battle. We certainly haven't won the war yet. But I don't want anyone running away with that idea. But it's been a real big step forward, and everybody deserves a pat on the back. And then they've got to get working again, because there's coastal whaling that's got to be stopped now.
So what do you think? Within 2 years, we're going to stop it completely?
Well, it's possible. I wouldn't like to say any more than that. You know, the IWC, they've been trudging along now for a long time, and they've been making a bit of a hash of it, you know. But they're starting to understand now, and I think we've got to hope that with the pressure that people can put on the governments of the world, that the whaling industry dies before the whale does.
Right, so just to sum up, write to the Prime Minister of Iceland, right?
Right, that would be a great
and
help.
as many of those letters as possible. What, that's Prime Minister of Iceland in Reykjavik, is it?
It is, yes. Just care of the Icelandic Parliament, Reykjavik, yeah.
Good. And obviously get in touch with Greenpeace, try and work things out there. Listen, good luck in Iceland. I hope it all works out fantastic.
Thanks very much indeed.
And thank you for coming out to see us.
You're welcome.
Really nice. Beautiful.
Talking to Peter Wilkinson of Greenpeace. If you'd like more information, write to Greenpeace at Colombo Street, London, SE1 8DP. That's Greenpeace, Colombo Street, London, SE1 8DP. You can also telephone them on 01633 0929. 01633 0929. I'm Tony Allen, and I hope you've enjoyed the last 45 minutes. You're tuned to 319 meters medium wave, 963 kilohertz. This is Caroline broadcasting live from the international waters of the North Sea. It's fast approaching 2 minutes past seven and time for Roy Masters with How Your Mind Can Keep You Well.
The foundation of human understanding teaches an observation exercise, often called meditation, which permits you to become objective toward your problems and allows your heartaches, bad habits, fears, and anxieties to be completely eliminated from your life without effort on your part. Until you've begun to practice this exercise, much of what you hear on the following program may be shocking and upsetting to you. But if you will listen calmly and with an open mind, you may discover the key to the peace of mind and joy for which you've been searching all of your life. And now, from the foundation of human understanding, here is Roy Masters.
Hello, welcome once again to the program, How Your Mind Can Keep You Well in a Moment of Truth. For the past week, I've been trying to understand the legal problems of as ruled by the Supreme Court about, well, many problems, but principally this week on the death penalty. And I've made my challenges over and over again, you know, about the constitutionality of it. Why can't the Supreme Court make up their mind what is constitution, what isn't constitutional, and why is, you know, the punishment different for a